You enchanted everyone entirely, Master. Anakin hardly knew what to say. Myself included. Picking at the sand by his feet, the Jedi shrugged disarmingly. Such is the power of story, my young Padawan. Anakin considered this carefully, as he was learning to do with everything Obi-Wan Kenobi said. You kept everyone in complete suspense. Suspension might be a better description. I never saw the happy ending coming and didn't expect it. Do all your stories have happy endings? Flicking a few grains of sand aside, Obi-Wan looked up at him sharply enough to give his apprentice an unexpected start. Only time will tell that, Anakin Skywalker. Unsatisfied, but understanding, Anakin turned away from his master to where Luminara had taken center stage. It wasn't much of a stage, he knew. The lighting was bad, the floor uneven, and one would flatter the audience by calling it unsophisticated, but she approached it as if it was the finest theater on Coruscant. She had spoken several times of feeling the chill carried by the wind that swept over the prairie, and so wore her long robes. Yiwa, who had been astounded at Barriss's acrobatics, softened by Anakin's singing and held spellbound by Obi-Wan's storytelling, now waited and watched expectantly to see what the last of the visitors would do. Luminara closed her eyes for a very long moment. Then she opened them and, kneeling, picked up a handful of sand. Straightening, she let it trickle out from between her fingers. Caught by the wind, the tiny grains formed a glittering whitish arc as they spilled from her hand. When she had emptied her palm, she slapped her hands gently together to brush away any remaining grains. Some of the Yiwa began to stir. This polite acknowledgment of their environs was something the smallest children of the clan could do for themselves. There was merit in the recognition, but little in the way of enlightenment. Surely there was more to come. There was. Kneeling again, Luminara picked up a second handful of sand, let it trickle from between her fingers. A few muted growls rose from the crowd. A concerned Barriss saw that Anakin was feeling the same confusion and uncertainty as herself. Nearby, Mazong frowned in disapproval. If anything, his advisors were even more discomfited. Only Obi-Wan appeared unworried. That in itself, she knew, was significant of nothing. He always looked that way. She found herself leaning forward and squinting. There was something different, something odd about the dribble of sand spilling from her master's fingers. It took her a moment to figure out what it was. When she did, despite what she knew of her master's capabilities, her mouth opened slightly. The sand was falling against the wind. It was just ordinary beach sand, drawn from the shores of the nearby lake, but in the delicate yet strong fingers of the Jedi, it became something magical. The light from the surrounding glow poles caught the falling grains, turning mica to mirrors and quartz into polished gems. When the last particles had fallen from Luminara's fingers, they reversed direction. A few hushed cries of "Pasha!" rose from the crowd as sand began to fall upward. Resembling a fragmented coil of wire, the column of grains began to wind itself around the Jedi, enclosing her in a slowly ascending spiral of sand. Like a serpent being born full-grown, another column lifted itself from the ground to entwine her a second time. As the sparkling sand spirals rotated in opposite directions, they splintered into smaller and smaller threads, until Luminara was shrouded in multiple strings composed of shattered, water-worn specks. It was as if she was engulfed by 30 thread-like pillars of dancing diamonds. She began to twirl, spinning slowly at first, balancing on one foot while the other pushed off and provided thrust. As she pirouetted, the glittering sand spirals responded, half turning with her, the other half rotating in the opposite direction. Though all was accomplished in complete silence, Barriss thought she heard music. A collective gasp erupted from the assembly. A blur of robes and sand, Luminara Unduli rose slightly from the ground. She continued to spin, her feet rising, until she was no more than a hand length off the ground. Still rotating, she tilted forward and began to spin and rotate simultaneously, holding her place in the air. was as unique a demonstration of control over the Force as Barriss had ever seen. Certainly the most breathtaking. Following her movements, the sand spirals rotated with her until they formed a near-solid globe of shining, sparkling particles around the almost hidden body. There came a soft puff of air, the sound of a cloud exhaling. Luminara landed on her feet, hands outstretched, feet spread shoulder-width apart. The curtaining sphere of sand that had formed around her fell to the ground. Lowering her arms, she bowed her head once before walking back to rejoin her friends. As she resumed her seat, Obi-Wan inclined slightly in her direction. "Okay, I'm impressed. How do you feel?"
"Dizzy."
Smiling softly, Luminara blinked several times. There was no applause, no whistling, no hissing, no celebratory cracking of joints. In ones and twos, alone and in family groups, the Clan Yiwa simply rose from their seats and melted away, returning to their collapsible homes and ceremonial fires. A number of armed males headed for their guard posts to take up the nocturnal watch for Shans and other predators that might try to prey on the slumbering herds. Sooner than expected, only the visitors were left, together with Mazong and his advisors. "The clan has hosted many recitals by many guests," the chieftain of the Yiwa began, "but never in living memory have any been so diverse, so unexpected, and so remarkable." "I didn't get a chance to show off my juggling," Bulgan murmured disappointedly. Kyakta jabbed him in the ribs. Mazong ignored the aside, pretending not to have heard it. "You have more than fulfilled your end of the bargain." Mazong conferred with his advisors. The two elders appeared to have lightened up considerably, Barriss decided. As the chieftain finally turned back to his guests, she drew her clothing tighter around her. Though the winds of Ancyon tended to diminish along with the daylight, they did not always cease entirely, and she was cold. "We concur," he gestured magnanimously at Kyakta and Bulgan. "We will give your guides such directions as will enable you to find the Baroki soonest." "How long until we reach their outlying factions?" Obi-Wan inquired. "That cannot be foretold." As Mazong stood, his guests rose with him. "The Baroki are also Alwari. They may be encamped, as are the Yiwa. But if they are on the move, you will still have some tracking to do. We can only point you in the direction of their last known campsite." He smiled reassuringly. "Do not despair. With our directions, you will find them far sooner than if you continued searching on your own."
"Thank you for your kindness and for your hospitality," Luminara told him.
Everyone's spirits had been raised by the encounter with the stolid but ultimately cooperative Yiwa, and they now had something in the way of a specific destination. At least, Barriss reflected as she relaxed in the saddle of her Subatar, they weren't galloping aimlessly over open prairie in the hope of accidentally bumping into the migrating overclan. Mazong's directions had been quite specific, though they still had to take into account his admonition that the Baroki might be on the move. She wondered how their habits and rituals would compare to those of the Yiwa. Within the numerous clans of the Alwari, Kyakta had told her, there existed much differentiation. They were traveling steadily north when their guides unexpectedly called a halt. Sitting up in her saddle, Barriss scanned their surroundings. The horizon was the same in every direction and had been for several days. Endless grassland, waving fields of native grains only rarely interrupted by clumps of small trees, an occasional depression holding water or mud, and the isolated hillock. Not a building of any kind, nor anything higher than a Subatar standing up on its rear and middle legs. So it was with interest she wondered why Kyakta and Bulgan had brought them to a stop, and why they appeared more than a little apprehensive. "What is it?" Luminara and Obi-Wan trotted forward to query their escorts. Attentive inspection of the four horizons left them no more enlightened as to the reason for the halt than it did their equally confused Padawans.
"Why have we stopped here?"
"Listen."
Both Alwari were leaning slightly forward in their seats, obviously straining to hear.
"What?"
Luminara and her companions went quiet. Only the muted munching of the Subatars, nibbling the tops off the ripe wild grains, the constant rustle of wind through the grasses, The occasional querulous hooting of a kilk stalking soft-shelled arthropods broke the silence. Then she heard it, faint initially, like a first cousin to the wind itself. It strengthened slowly, a soft ripping sound approaching from the north, from the direction they were headed. It intensified until it became an audible buzzing, still muted but rising ominously in the distance. Peering hard in the direction of the ascending susurration, Luminara thought she could make out the first hints of a low, dark cloud. The subatars began to stir uneasily, throwing back their sharp-ridged skulls and pawing at the ground with middle and forefeet. She struggled to control her mount. At the same time, Kyakta's eyes bulged with realization.
Chiron! He exclaimed fearfully.
Quickly, my friends! Bulgan was suddenly standing upright in his saddle, looking frantically in all directions.
We have to find shelter!
Shelter? Obi-Wan held his seat, but began searching their immediate surroundings nonetheless. Out here? From what? Barriss wanted to know. By now, she too saw and heard the onrushing blur. What's a Chiron? Without suspending his search, Bulgan edged his steed closer to her own.
A flying creature that travels the plains of Ancyon, migrating from region to region as it follows the seasons.
He gestured downward. When the grasses in one area mature and the heads of each stalk are ripe with seed, the Chiron resumes its flight, eating until it is sated. Then it settles down to rest and to breed. When the young are fledged, they take flight anew in search of further nourishment.
She blinked in the direction of the diffuse shadow on the horizon.
That can't be all one creature coming toward us.
It's not, Bulgan disclosed apprehensively. There are many more than one.
I don't see why it matters.
Anakin had moved forward to join the conversation.
What have we to fear from a flock of seed-eaters? They are just seed-eaters, aren't they?
He thought to add.
A strange expression came over the guide's face, strange even for a pop-eyed, long-maned, single-nostriled Ancyonian.
Seed is their preferred food, yes, but once they have taken flight, they are unable or unwilling or simply disinterested in changing course. Nor will they fly higher to pass over anything unexpected in their path.
He swallowed hard.
Rocks they will smash themselves into, trees they will cut down, living things like hootles or subatars or sitsian, they will eat their way through. Unless those creatures can somehow find a place to hide or manage to get out of the way.
Hootles or subatars? Barriss asked softly. Or people?
Somehow she wasn't surprised when Bulgan nodded solemnly. Anakin's hand strayed to his belt.
We have lightsabers and other weapons. Can't we stand and defend ourselves from these things? How big are they, anyway?
Raising his long-fingered hands, Bulgan placed them on either side of his head.
This is the average of their wingspan.
That's all?
Anakin frowned. Then I don't see why you and Kyakta are so concerned.
How many of them are there? Barriss asked. In the average flock?
Lowering his hands, the guide looked back at her.
No one knows. No one has ever been able to stay in one place long enough to count an average flock.
He gestured toward the now rapidly darkening northern horizon.
I think this flock may be a little larger than average.
Take a guess.
The fingers of Anakin's right hand continued to hover in the vicinity of his lightsaber.
How many of these things are we likely to be facing?
Turning in his saddle, Bulgan considered the horizon anew.
Not a conspicuously great number, but enough to pose a serious danger if we don't find cover quickly. No more than 100 or 200 million, I would say.
Anakin's hand moved away from his lightsaber.
100 million? 1 or 2?
The only shelter in sight was a trio of Wolgin trees standing forlorn and isolated off to their right. They did not cast much of a shadow.
This way!
Pointing forward and to his left, Kyakta urged his mount in that same direction. The two Jedi Knights followed, with the Padawans bringing up the rear. Barriss tried her best to conceal her unease. Instead of fleeing, they were riding straight into the oncoming adumbration. On a collision course, Chiron flock and speeding travelers drew rapidly toward one another. Though she had never seen a Chiron in her life, she trusted that Kyakta had seen something more substantial than a mirage, more solid than faint hope. Several minutes of hard riding later, it was still impossible to make out individual Chiron.
but their collective screeching had come to dominate all other sounds on the prairie. As she had been instructed, Luminara urged her subatar faster, not wanting to fall behind. There were some instruments of nature even a master of the force could not stand against. One Chiron, without question. A dozen, surely. A few hundred, perhaps. A few thousand? Questionable. 100 million of anything was too vast a number for even several Jedi to stand against. Even if the adversaries in question were nothing more than small, soft-bodied, seed-eating flyers. By the time she finally saw where Kyakta was leading them, the collective cries of the millions upon millions of Chiron were a steady stabbing in her ears. They blocked out the sun, creating their own eclipse, and their stench threatened to overwhelm her inundated sense of smell and send her reeling. Grimly, she clung to the reins of her mount and kept her feet jammed resolutely into the forward-facing stirrups. With one hand, she pulled a bit of robe across her face to shut out a little of the dust and smell. There! That way! Peering into the gathering darkness, she barely managed to hear Kyakta's cry and see where he was leading them. Looming out of the gloom just ahead and towering above the grass, a crazy conglomeration of tilted pillars and columns took shape. Ranging in hue from a light tan to dark umber, more than anything else, they resembled alien tombstones set in the middle of the open plain. The analogy was not encouraging. Roughly triangular in shape, each rose to a sharp point. Not all were perfectly vertical. Some thrust upward from the ground at marked angles, and several lay broken and shattered, having fallen over on their sides. She later learned they were mounds of the Jijites, tiny creatures that lived in the soil and fed off the wide-ranging root systems of the numerous grasses. Constructed of tiny, even minuscule pebbles, they were bound together by a natural mortar extruded by specially designated Jijite workers. Each pillar served to vent hot air from the living tunnels below the surface, cooling the Jijites' immediate environment. They were also lookout towers from which far-sighted Jijites could keep watch on the surrounding plains and on other marauding members of their own kind. They were not insects, but a kind of collective small reptilian life form. No four-legged lookouts were visible now, peering watchfully out of red-slitted eyes at the surrounding prairie. Having long since detected the oncoming Chiron, they and their brethren had moved deep into the earth, down to multiple burrows safe from the onrushing swarm. Luminara had to work hard to slow her speeding subatar so that it wouldn't race past the aggregation of pillars. Shouting to make himself heard, Kyakta indicated that they had to split up into groups of two, since even the largest of the columns could effectively shelter no more than that. Obi-Wan didn't like the idea, but they had no choice and no time for debate. True, they could have stayed together, clinging to one another for support and reassurance, but that would have meant tethering their mounts separately, with no riders to control them. They hurriedly dismounted. If one subatar panics, Vulcan explained, putting his mouth close to Luminara's ear in order to make himself heard, the rest may stampede with it. That's the way it is with all herd animals on the prairies. They rely on each other's reactions for protection from danger. If you are potential prey, it's better to bolt than to stand around assessing the situation for yourself. He clung tightly to the reins of his own steed. If we don't stay with our mounts, we might well lose them. He nodded in Obi-Wan's direction. I know you have the means for contacting Kupernam and calling for rescue, but not even an armored land speeder could force its way through a Chiron flock. This is our only chance. She indicated understanding.
I doubt we have time to call for help anyway. Very well, Bulgan, we'll split up.
They discussed the situation quickly, with no wasted words. Much as Luminara wanted to stay with Barriss and Obi-Wan with Anakin, it made more sense to pair each of the Padawans with one of the more experienced guides. The two masters would take their own animals down behind the largest of the artificial pillars. Though the distance between columns was small, the sense of parting was disproportionately great. As soon as she and Obi-Wan succeeded in persuading their animals to lie down behind the brown column, they took shelter themselves, huddling close together in the middle of the triangular pillar. The sky was now as dark as during a cloudy sunset. Something made a faint smacking sound behind the two huddled Jedi. It was followed by another, and then more, in rapid succession. Then the swarm began to pass by overhead, and the smacking noises became a steady, dull battering and splatting against the other side of the pillar.
Luminara found herself giving thanks to tiny burrowing creatures she had never seen. It was their regurgitative engineering that was providing protection for the travelers and keeping them alive. But for how long? The sound of airborne Chiron slamming into the pillar rose in volume until the conglomeration of stone and cement-like saliva began to tremble against their backs. How far did the flock extend? How long would it take for it to pass over? Would their pillar and those shielding their companions be able to withstand the relentless pressure of hundreds, perhaps thousands, of Chiron hurling themselves aimlessly against it? Black shapes numbering in the tens of millions pelted past at high speed. In the crush of small bodies, it was impossible to make out individuals. The swarm was a cyclonic mass of wings, eyes, and gaping mouths. They sat scrunched up against the Gigi pillar for what seemed like the entire morning, but in reality it was less than an hour. The Subatars huddled against one another for comfort and protection, their long, narrow heads resting plaintively on the ground. Chiron shot past on either side or overhead, too intent on maintaining their flight paths to swerve even slightly to left or right and nip at the grass that was bent beneath the weight of resting Subatar jaws. The stone column that was the only protection for human and steed alike continued to shudder beneath the impact of hundreds of suicidal bodies. With the airspace on all sides of them occupied, hemmed in above by tens of thousands of their brethren, the Chiron that slammed into the pillar were compelled to sacrifice themselves out of instinct, not a desire to commit mass suicide. They did not perish willingly. They simply had nowhere else to go. The sky was full. After a while, the sound of bodies hitting the stone column began to fade, even though the blizzard of black shapes continued to thunder past unabated. Eventually, even that sound began to dissipate. Soon only thousands of Chiron were rushing by the pillar, then hundreds. The sky brightened, black giving way once more to blue. A few clouds appeared. Looking to his right, Obi-Wan could once more make out the seated forms of Barriss and Bulgan, seated behind their indomitable Gigite shield. When the last stragglers had passed and could be seen flapping madly southward in frantic attempts to keep up with the main flock, the travelers rose from their places of rest and protection for a joyful but solemn reunion. Tension had tired them, but any feelings of fatigue were more than offset by the relief they felt. No one had been hurt, although a curious Anakin had been struck in the face when he had tried to peer briefly around his and Kyakta's protective column. A small scratch across his forehead was the only indication of the fortunately brief encounter with airborne Chiron. It was a worthwhile lesson. Sometimes danger came not from the powerful and overbearing, but from the small and the overlooked. The meticulousness with which the mighty swarm had fed was remarkable to see. The only grass stalks that had been knocked down were those that had been trapped beneath the prone resting Subatars. The Chiron had not flattened a single section of prairie. Every stalk remained standing, but nearly all had been shorn of their ripened seed. As far as the eye could see, the grassland looked as if it had been given a clipping by the largest and most perfect of all mowers. With her great wealth, the president of the Commerce Guild could command entire legions of servants, thousands of workers, dozens of bodyguards. The multiple enterprises of her people spanned the civilized galaxy, reaching from one end of the Republic to another. She was universally acknowledged, even by her most fervent competitors, to be an individual of unusual intelligence and perspicacity. Usually, a few minutes was enough time to enable her to size up an opponent or a friend. Take Senator Mosul. Talented but vain, loyal but self-centered, he had to be watched at all times. Not that Shumai thought him unreliable. The senator was in too deep and had too much at stake to risk quitting now. Shumai had seen him at work in the Senate. Mosul could be a mesmerizing speaker. But outside the Senate, removed from his official position of power, he was just another Ancionian, and therefore had to be watched. What was important was that they had the same view of the future, of where the diseased, tottering Republic was going. With the Senator's political acumen and alliances, and the Commerce Guild's financial and commercial resources, there was nothing they could not accomplish. But not quite yet. The Republic was still powerful, its long-established institutions not quite weak enough to be ignored.
In matters of political policy, she tended to defer to the senator, though not always. Shumai respected her associate's opinions, just as Mosul believed the president of the Commerce Guild listened attentively to his advice. What the senator sometimes failed to acknowledge was that he was by several orders of magnitude the junior partner in their mutual arrangement. Adept as he was at massaging the egos of fellow politicians, Mosul was content to let Shumai deal with the unseen one whose interests they represented. The watercraft on which they were presently relaxing drifted freely on Savam Lake, an exquisite body of water that, like everything else on Coruscant, was artificial in nature. It was a private playground of the very rich, lined with trees and genetically engineered flowers that bloomed year-round, filling the air with 100 different scents. Other boats cruised sedately nearby, some larger than Shumai's, some smaller. She could have overawed them all, but preferred not to be conspicuous. The two were the only ones on the boat. Live servants had ears with which to listen. The pilot droids did not.
"Our supporters grow impatient."
Mosul let the sun bake his chest, its rays carefully filtered through the inconspicuous polarized shield that hovered above the boat.
"Tam Yulis in particular worries me.
Impatience is a potentially fatal disease."
Rolling to her left, Shumai picked up the spiral tumbler of refreshment and sipped contentedly at its contents.
"According to everything you tell me, events on Ancyon are unfolding at a predictable and reasonable speed. The others must learn to contain their impulsiveness."
"It isn't easy, you know, to restrain people caught up in the grip of a new idea."
Raising her tumbler, Shumai gazed through the liquid-filled transparency. It colored the sunlight gold.
"That's your job, my friend. I handle the guild, you keep the local political and business interests in check. We'll move only when the time is right."
Mosul bridled inwardly at what sounded like a directive. Outwardly, he smiled and nodded. For now, Shumai was in control. Let her dream her dreams of personal grandiosity. When Ancyon seceded and Mosul was appointed sector governor, their positions would be reversed. Then it was Shumai and her guild that would come calling in search of favors. He met his smaller colleague's gaze evenly.
"These Jedi complicate matters. Whatever Yulis and the others think, no legitimate vote can go forward until they have been dealt with. I have been in regular contact with our agent there, and I've been assured as recently as yesterday that the visitors will be neutralized."
"They'd better be."
With a soft grunt, Shumai leaned back in her chair.
"If only the Jedi Knights could be brought around to our way of thinking, it would simplify everything greatly."
"Won't happen."
Mosul stirred his drink with a finger, activating a few more of the time-released narcotics swirling within.
"The Jedi can't be bent."
The president of the Commerce Guild shrugged.
"It may be that some are not so staunch as you believe."
Mosul blinked at his co-conspirator.
"What do you mean?"
"Time will reveal all. Meanwhile, events on Ancyon will unfold at their own speed. While they do, you and I must wait, and persuade the others to do likewise."
She took a long swallow of her own non-narcotic-infused drink. Mosul grunted and went silent. While it was true that life was transitory and the window of opportunity to do great things fleeting, they could not be rushed. To move too soon would be to risk everything. Beneath the two, who rested and plotted and warmed themselves in Coruscant's beneficent sun, thousands of lesser beings toiled in the great interlocked buildings 200 stories high, whose roof was the lake known as Savam. Following the route proposed by the Yiwa brought the travelers to a line of high hills that stretched unbroken across the northern horizon. Kiakta and Bulgan did not know their names, but a few of the prominences were almost high enough to be called mountains. Gentle of slope, with only a few isolated cliff faces but many water-worn undercuts and overhangs, they presented no barrier to the wonderfully long-legged Subatars. Still, to save time and preserve the strength of their mounts, the travelers chose to continue forward through one of several meandering gaps that cut through the range. It was when she was preparing to climb back onto the saddle of her mount after a brief rest that Barriss noticed the creature digging through the supply pack that was tied across the Subatar's second back.
Momentarily startled by the unexpected sight, she froze. It looked very much like any other Ancyonian. The bright convex eyes, the bipedal build, and the long nimble fingers and toes were identical. But instead of the narrow mane that ran from the top of the head down to the spine to terminate in a short tail, this intruder was completely covered in short, dense, dark brown and beige fur striped with dull yellow markings. Instead of a twitchy stub, its weaving tail was as long as her arm. Most striking of all, it barely came up to her waist.
"Hey, stop that!" she yelled in all-purpose Ancyonian.
Both arms laden with the trio of flexi-wrapped food packs, the startled intruder looked up in response to her sudden shout. Emitting a defiant squeal, it turned and leapt off the back of the indifferent Subatar, vanishing beneath a protruding shelf of rock. Determined not to let the prowler get away, she rose to her feet and raced after it. If the rocky cleft branched off into multiple passages, she would have to terminate the chase and return, defeated, to her companions. On the other hand, if it dead-ended somewhere not far ahead, she would have the furry bandit cornered. Though clearly cut by running water, the crevice cooperated by not splitting into different branches. Agile though he was, the intruder was slowed by his ill-gotten burden. He never managed to slip entirely out of her sight. In fact, Barris was gaining on him noticeably when he suddenly turned to confront her. Jumping up and down, he proceeded to unload on her a series of furious squeals that she struggled to translate. The dialect was far more difficult to decipher than the comparatively sophisticated speech of the city, the idiom spoken by Kyakta and Bolgan, or even the rough variant that was employed by the wandering Yiwa.
Get back, go away, leave alone!"
In addition to these straightforward exclamations, there were also numerous rapid-fire individual phrases that proved beyond her capacity to interpret, but whose general implication could be inferred from the vaguely obscene gestures that accompanied them. On careful consideration, Barris did not believe any were intended to be flattering. Such imprecations and insults didn't bother her. What did were the dozens of echoing comments and cries that emanated from the thief's cohorts, who by now lined both sides of the crevice's upper rim. Yelling and screaming, they hurled exceptionally inventive epithets down at her while their absconding colleague stood his ground and assumed a posture of unmistakable triumph. The sight of them was as astonishing as it was unexpected. Despite their diminutive stature, proportionately slightly larger eyes, and full fur body covering, the similarities to the dominant Ancyonian race were unmistakable. Her little thief and his comrades clearly represented a distinct branching of Kyakta's and Bulgan's species, a dwarf genetic offshoot. Already she'd recognized their speech as a variant of the Ancyonian norm. Every one of them, she noted, boasted a different pattern in its fur. The cleft in the hill was a dead end, all right, for both thief and pursuer. But he was the one with the swarm of allies. It occurred to her that not only did her companions not know she was in trouble, they didn't even know where she was. Master Luminara would be displeased. Cautiously reaching for her lightsaber, Barris hoped fervently that she would be able to accept that displeasure in person. With unflagging energy and enthusiasm, the thief was jumping wildly up and down.
Tookie, fool you! You trapped good now, you big bag bald bully goo! Squinty eyes! Syrup stink! What you do now?
That depended entirely, she knew, on what the thief's comrades did next. If she backed slowly down the crevice, retracing her steps, would they track her retreat from above? Or would they immediately lose interest in lieu of scrambling down to fight one another over a share of their successful colleague's plunder? The answer came in the form of a hail of stones. None was particularly big, but she would only have to catch one fist-sized rock between the eyes to be knocked senseless. Derived from her training, her response was pure reflex. Raising a hand, Barris concentrated hard, hard. The flung stones hit the sides of the narrow cleft. They struck the floor at her feet, but none made contact with her. She was too busy focusing on deflecting the missiles to wonder how long she could maintain her concentration. Sweat began to bead on her forehead. She couldn't spare the energy to yell for help. Given the twists and turns in the cleft and the distance she'd come, she doubted her shouts would be heard by her friends anyway. Just as Barris felt she was going to pass out from the strain, the barrage slowed, to finally cease altogether. Overhead, the assembled creatures turned from attacking her to jabbering excitedly at one another. Occasionally, one would point down at their intended target standing cornered below. At such moments, she strove to project an air of complete confidence, even indifference. The pain in her head was beginning to fade. She saw one of her assailants shove another. A couple of fights broke out among the stone throwers, all long slapping fingers and tiny angry fists. Apparently, her assailants were a fractious bunch. Hoping she remembered enough of the language course and still keeping a wary eye out for the odd hurled rock, Barris tilted her head back and addressed them forcefully. "Listen to me!" Stunned debaters immediately ceased their arguing. Several dozen wide-eyed faces turned to look down at her. "There's no need for us to fight. My friends and I mean you no harm. We're not from this world, from Ancyon. We're humans, and we'd like to be friends. Understand? Friends." Turning slightly, she pointed back the way she'd come. "Two of my companions are Jedi Knights. I and one other are their Padawans, their apprentices. We also have two Alwari guides with us." She should have stopped with her own identification. At the mention of the guides, the assembled group resumed their leaping and howling, though not quite as vociferously as before, she noted. She struggled to keep up with the meanings of their overlapping cries.
"Hate Alwari! Alwari bad, bad, bad! No Alwari here! Kill Alwari! Alwari go away, away!"
A few picked up and brandished fresh stones. She raised both hands.
"Please, listen to me. The two Alwari who travel with us are not only from another part of this world, they're clanless. They are completely under the control of myself and my friends, and will not harm you. We just want to be friends."
The flourished stones were not set aside, but they were lowered. Once more, the creatures lining the rim resumed their internal bickering. If not for their uninhibited belligerence, they really were quite attractive, she decided, in the diversity of their full-body fur. Eventually, the squabbling diminished, though it didn't cease entirely. A gray-coated individual, clearly an elder, leaned over the rim of the crevice to peer down at her.
"You strange person, you is! What a Jedi Knight!"
"What a human!"
exclaimed another, interrupting. Suddenly, Barris was inundated by a volley not of stones, but of queries. Wrestling with her limited local vocabulary, she did her best to answer them all. "Not all nomads are bad," Barris told them. "The Alwari are like any other people. There are good people among them and bad people. My kind, humans, are no different. There is good and bad in everyone."
"Nomads kill Gwyrin,"
one of the tribe's people informed her.
"Gwyrin have to live here in hill country to survive."
"Not our nomads," she countered. "Like I told you, they come from far, far away. I'm sure they've never heard a Gwyrin in their lives. They may never even have seen one of your kind." Even as she said it, she fervently hoped it was true. It was hard to imagine the thoughtful Kyakta or the kindly Bulgan ever showing such unreasoning hostility to a cousin, even in their formerly addled condition.
"Why not come and see for yourselves? Come back with me and meet my friends. We'll have a party. You can try some interesting food."
Her assailants exchanged dawning glances.
"Party?"
someone murmured hopefully.
"Food?"
exclaimed another expectantly.
"Is anybody listening to me?"
Having spent some time now bouncing off the walls, the Gwyrin who called himself Tuki was out of breath and out of energy.
"This Tuki talking! You know Tuki? Tuki who..."
Dumping his ill-gotten gains indifferently to one side, the thief sat down on the gravel floor of the fissure and exhaled deeply.
"Ah, Moochpuck! Nobody care! Gwyrin bunch of brainless bonehead stupids!"
Thrusting an accusing finger at Barris, Tuki raised what was left of his voice.
"'Tis all you fault, you small-head outland big lips! You twist word noises, make friends forget Tuki! I hate you!"
She walked toward the disheartened thief. Everyone on the rim above went suddenly quiet. As for the talkative Tuki, seeing the much larger stranger approach, he picked up one of the food packs and backed up as far as he could.
"You keep away from Tuki, you long-leg ugly bean thing! Tuki fight you! Tuki kill!"
Halting, she indicated the food pack he held awkwardly in a throwing position. "Not with a few packets of dehydrated energy pudding, I don't think." To make herself less intimidating, she knelt, bringing her face as close to the Gwuren's level as she could manage.
I don't want to hurt you, Tuki. I want us to be friends.
She nodded up at his comrades who lined the top of the fissure. Some still held rocks in their small but strong three-fingered hands. She fought not to show her nervousness.
I want all of us to be friends.
The Gwuren hesitated, aware that his fellow tribesfolk were following with great interest the confrontation being played out below.
You not hurt Tuki? You not angry with him?
She smiled engagingly.
On the contrary, I admire you for what you did. I imagine it's not every Gwuren who would be so bold as to try to steal in broad daylight from a party of tall, strong off-worlders like myself and my companions.
Though still uncertain and continuing to eye her guardedly, he slowly lowered the food pack and moved away from the wall.
Jaja, the trousseau! Nobody but Tuki brave or clever enough to do it.
He came a little closer.
Tuki bravest brave of all Gwuren.
I don't doubt it, she responded, repressing a smile. Actually, I think you're kind of friendly. He took immediate offense, standing as tall as he could. This brought his face up to the level of the Padawan's stomach.
Tuki not friendly. Tuki most fierce, ferocious slayer of all Gwuren enemies.
I'm sure you are, she agreed, reaching out to brush the fur on his forehead from back to front.
He stumbled away from her, flailing irately at his head as he struggled to smooth down his ruffled fur.
Don't do that! Don't touch Tuki!
Fur once more flattened and smoothed back, he glared up at her out of bulging orange-tinted eyes.
Tuki have much dignity.
Sorry.
She lowered her offending hand, palm outward.
Now, if you and I are going to be friends, Tuki, and if you're going to join the party, you have to return what you took.
The Gwuren eyed the three food packs uncertainly.
Tuki work hard for to steal this stuff.
Take my word for it, you wouldn't like it anyway. At least not until it's been properly rehydrated. If you come back with me, I'll see that you're the first one who gets to taste it.
First one? Tuki be first?
His single nostril sniffed at the pack he still held.
Tuki always first!
In your own mind, anyway, you sly little sneak.
It's settled, then? You'll come back with me? We'll be friends, and we'll have a party?
The Gwuren vacillated only a moment longer. Then he confidently placed first one food pack, and then the other two in Barriss's waiting arms.
Tuki consent to join you.
Leaning back, he regarded his comrades on the rim above.
It okay now. Tuki makes stranger harmless. All Gwuren can come down safely now. We go to see what nasty, ugly outlander strangers got to offer Gwuren.
Smiling to herself at the little brigand's bravado, Barriss waited while the rest of the chattering Gwuren, agile as spiders, scrambled down the walls of the fissure to join them. Tuki's blustering notwithstanding, they largely ignored him as they pushed and shoved to get close to her, feeling her feet, her exposed lower arms, and her protective clothing. She put up with their innocent, wide-eyed curiosity for several minutes, until it threatened to become more intimate than she was prepared to tolerate. Then she shrugged them off and started back down the cleft, the three food packs slung over her left shoulder, accompanied by the entire tribe of chattering, jabbering, energized Gwuren.
She just can't have disappeared into thin air.
For the 10th or maybe the 20th time, Luminara ran through the list of possibilities. Barriss had gone walking outside the protective overhang and had managed to get herself lost. She had found something of interest and wandered off into the hills. Something vast and voracious had swooped down out of the sky and carried her off. Movement made her turn. Obi-Wan, Anakin, and Kyakta returned from searching the slopes outside their little refuge.
No sign of her anywhere.
Anakin's tone was full of concern. Bulgan looked up at her out of his one good eye.
We'll take the Subatars and make a spiraling sweep of these hills and gullies, Master Luminara. We can cover much more ground that way. Perhaps she has fallen into a hole in the rocks and hurt a leg.
A worried Luminara nodded absently. Sitting high up on the back of a Subatar would certainly provide a better view than was available from searching on foot. The implications of the Alwari's observation were distressing. If Barriss had fallen into a hole, and if the hole was big enough, and if she had been knocked unconscious, they might never find her. That was when they heard a voice hailing them.
"Hey, everybody, I'm over here!"
Racing around a pair of resting Subatars, they saw the object of everyone's present concern emerging on all fours from beneath a projecting slab of rock. The crawlway it concealed was exceedingly well hidden from anyone not standing directly in front of it and bending to look under the jutting stone.
"Barriss, are you all—"
Slowing as she drew near, Luminara's expression quickly changed from open concern to a reproving scowl.
"Where have you been, Padawan? We've been looking all over for you, and— Are you hurt?"
"No, I'm fine."
Rising from the crawlway, Barriss brushed dust from her hands and stretched.
"And so are our new friends."
Luminara was not alone in taking a couple of surprised steps backward as a veritable deluge of noisy, jabbering, furry bipeds spewed from the concealed crawlway. In an instant, they were investigating Barriss's companions with the same candid zeal and lack of discretion they had shown toward her.
"Subatar!"
one shouted as it clambered up onto the back of Kiakta's mount. Glowering his irritation, the guide hurried toward it.
"You little fellow! Get down from there! Get down just now!"
Sitting atop the unconcerned Subatar's middle shoulders, the brown and blue Gurren made energetic faces down at the aggravated guide.
"Ningwa Nooglik! Goofy talking no hair outlander darling! You make me!
Why, you little—"
Kiakta would have started up after the taunting pygmy, but Luminara called him back.
"Never mind that one now, Kiakta."
"But, Master Luminara, it is—"
"I said never mind. Come and meet these people."
"People?"
Muttering under his breath, Kiakta reluctantly complied with the Jedi's order.
"These are not people. These are dirt crawlers."
As Barriss proceeded to explain the reasons for her extended absence, Luminara was soon mollified. The Padawan's tale was brief but intriguing.
"And so I convinced Tuki here to return what he'd taken and to bring along his whole tribe with him."
Barriss eyed her teacher hesitantly.
"I promised them a kind of a party."
Luminara frowned.
"This is not a pleasure trip, Padawan. Obi-Wan, what do you think about this?"
The other Jedi considered. After a moment, somewhat unexpectedly, he grinned. "A Padawan's promise does not bind a Jedi, but that doesn't mean it should not be honored. We don't have musicians, and speaking for myself, I feel I've already done enough entertaining on this journey. But we can certainly show them some things and let them try a taste of our food. Maybe they'll consider accepting a little education about the galaxy at large in place of singing and dancing. Perhaps that'll be enough entertainment for this get-together to qualify as a party." Actually, it did not matter what the travelers did. The Gwurren seemed to find everything and anything about the humans most amusing. Wholly devoid of tact, they crawled over everything, travelers, dozing Subatars, and supply packs alike. But there were no more attempts at petty theft. When one adolescent attempted to make off with a plasticine pack covering, she was roundly chastised by several of the adults. Luminara was gratified to see that friendship, if not comprehensive understanding, had been established. It was as they were making final preparations for departure that Luminara felt a tug at her pant leg. Looking down, she saw a Gwurren she recognized. It was Tuki, the enterprising and unusually bold would-be thief who had led a persistent Barriss to his tribe.
"What is it, Tuki?"
she inquired politely. "We're almost ready to go, you know."
"Tuki no."
He slapped both long-fingered hands against the striped brown and black fur that covered his chest.
"Tuki, bravest of all Gwurren! The best fighter, the smartest, the most handsomest, the—"
"Yes, you're a fine representative of your tribe, Tuki," Luminara agreed absently as she checked the supply pack harness of her patient Subatar. "I'm sure they're very proud of you."
"Pifka!"
he exclaimed sharply.
"Gwurren multiple stupids. Got no dreams, no purposes, no goals.
happy living in holes in hills."
The little thief managed the difficult task of appearing to strut while standing still.
"Tuki want more. Tuki got to have more."
Bulbous red-orange eyes gazed up at her.
"I want go with you."
That put pause to her inspection. Squatting, she gazed apologetically into those oversized, staring eyes.
"Tuki, you can't come with us. You know that." "Know what? Don't know that."
The Gwirin was not in the least intimidated by the much bigger Jedi.
"Tuki know only what he can see. See that you have plenty room on great big riding subatars for little guy like Tuki. I fight hard, don't eat much. Usually."
She had to smile.
"You mean, usually you fight hard, or usually you don't eat much?"
Taking a step back, he kicked angrily at the ground.
"Don't word game, Tuki. I not stupid like those other ground burrowers. Tuki smart.
"Smart enough to steal from us when we're sleeping?" she inquired pointedly. Placing his right hand over his face and his left over the back of his head, he declaimed as sonorously as his small stature would permit.
"May Tuki shrivel in the sun if he ever take a grain crumb from his new friends without asking. May his insides spill out on the ground and run away like worm suckers. May all his relatives burn in grass fire that cleans the open spaces and—"
All right. She was laughing softly despite herself. "I get the picture." Although she had the feeling that Tuki wouldn't particularly mind if certain of his relatives did happen to meet an untimely and unpleasant end.
"You're brave and true, but we still can't take you with us. As Barriss has already told you and your fellows, we're engaged in a difficult and dangerous mission and have no time to look after guests." "Tuki take care of self. You see. Tuki not afraid of danger."
Once more, he slapped himself on the chest.
"Tuki eat danger for morning meal."
"Please." Turning to resume her final packing check, Luminara grumbled as she struggled to secure a strap seal. "If you want to take responsibility for him, Barriss, then I suppose he can come along." She looked back sharply. "But if you cause us the least trouble, Tuki, if you slow us down or impede our work in any way, then you have to leave. It's back to the hills for you and no arguments. Agreed?"
Repeating his hands over face and head gesture, the eager Gwirin replied without hesitation. "If I cause any impede thing, may I rot slowly in decaying water. May all my fur turn purple and I sick turn myself inside out. May I chew on my feet and—"
"Just keep him quiet," an exasperated Luminara instructed her Padawan. "And away from me. He'll be good." Bending over, Barriss patted the Gwirin on his furry pate. "Won't you, Tuki?"
"Good as a Gwirin can be,"
he told her genially. Somehow, Luminara did not find that pledge particularly reassuring. The sun was beginning to rise over the northern horizon. It was the same horizon they had been riding toward for days, flat and grassy. "Something moving from east to west along the horizon," Gyakta called out. Though still waking up, everyone immediately turned in that direction. Obi-Wan had his electro-binoculars out and was gazing at the indicated spot, trying to resolve the distant movement. "Baroki?" Anakin inquired hopefully. Lowering the powerful scanning device, the Jedi replied uncertainly. "I don't know. Kyakta and Bulgan will tell us, but I have a feeling not." It was Bulgan who eventually identified the clanging, noisy procession as soon as it had drawn near enough to be recognized. "It's a Kulun clan. The Kulun are traders. They operate freely among both the Alwari and the city folk. Though no one likes them very much, there's a need for them out on the plains in the absence of shops and communications." The three riders who broke away from the main column headed straight toward the group of travelers, who responded by slowing to meet them. Otherwise, the Subatars would have easily outdistanced the powerful but much shorter Sadanes. Falling in line alongside Luminara's and Barriss's mounts, the trio of Kulun flashed wide smiles and waved energetic greetings. Save for their far louder, more garish attire, two of the riders could have passed unnoticed among the Yiwa.
Not their leader, though, for such he obviously was. Unlike his companions, or for that matter, Kiakta, he had no mane running from the top of his head down his back. His bald head, gleaming in the morning sun, was as distinctive as his girth. For all that, he rode gracefully atop his hard-working steed.
Welcome, off-worlders! The Kulun bid you welcome!
Luminara tried to remember how many spaceports Ancion boasted. Clearly, these traders, or at least their leader, had visited one or more where he had enjoyed the opportunity to encounter sentience from other parts of the Republic.
Thankings for your greeting,
Kiakta responded formally.
We ride north.
So we see.
Performing a wondrously gravity-defying stunt, the portly leader bowed without falling off his mount.
I am Bayuntu, chief trader of this clan faction. What seek a mix of off-worlders and Alwari in the North Country?
Appreciative of the chief's description of him as Alwari, Kiakta replied with good grace.
The Baroki.
Baroki? What do off-worlders seek among the Overclan?
Leaning slightly outward from his saddle, Obi-Wan replied with a question of his own while simultaneously ignoring the chieftains.
Can you help us?
Perhaps, perhaps.
Forgoing the reins of his sardane along with his query, the chief extended both heavy arms wide. Luminara watched in fascination. Bayuntu was the first truly portly Ancionian she had seen.
Tonight, you dine with us. The Kulun are always keen on company. New faces mean new news.
And potential new customers, Anakin murmured across to Barriss. Though I wouldn't see that as a reason not to chat with them. It's not up to us. Though she professed disinterest, Barriss hoped the Masters would consent to the Kulun leader's request. It would be yet another chance to learn more about Ancionian society. And besides, the food would be fresh. Obi-Wan and Luminara saw no reason not to stop and spend the night among the effervescent traders. Riding importantly in the lead, Bayuntu led the visitors to the top of the ridge where the Kulun were making camp. Self-erecting dwellings were already unfolding walls and roofs, while busy adolescents attached heating equipment and atmospheric water condensers. Automatic braces secured the temporary structures, which were designed to be put up and taken down every day, against the ubiquitous wind. Wonderfully decorated with enamels, painted mirrors, and all manner of eye candy. Bayuntu was delighted to have off-world visitors.
I have met many in my dealings, he told them that evening as they shared the comforts of the designated visitor's house.
In Kupernam?
Anakin was munching on something blue-green, plump, and delicious.
In Kupernam, their host boasted, and in Doigan and Flerau, a smattering of your own kind as well as a most interesting variety of others.
He rested both pudgy, long-fingered hands on his imposing belly.
Merchants are a species unto themselves, it seems. Shape has nothing to do with it. The Kulun realized this from the first time a vessel from another world set down here to trade.
Then you feel that the Kulun have benefited from Ancion's membership in the Republic?
Luminara inquired encouragingly. Their host made a face.
Oh, I would rather talk business than politics, but since you ask, yes, I do.
And your clan folk feel similarly?
Obi-Wan sipped at something sweet, warm, and refreshing.
That I cannot say. Most are not so sophisticated in such matters as Bayuntu. Like all true Kulun, they will give their allegiance to whomever they believe will make them the most money.
So they can be bought, Anakin commented.
Obi-Wan gave the Padawan a sharp look, but the younger man only shrugged, seeing nothing wrong with the question. His teacher should know by now that his Padawan was nothing if not direct. Certainly their host took no offense.
Any merchant can be bought, my large, furless young friend. That is the nature of business, is it not? To the Kulun, loyalty is just another commodity. For the moment, we are happy to see Ancion fully represented in the Republic. As to what tomorrow may bring, who am I to say?
Grunting with the effort, he leaned back against his pile of supporting cushions. Multiple tiny sensors and equally minuscule motors shifted mass within each cushion to provide the necessary support.
An honest response, anyway, Luminara murmured to Barris. I suppose we can't expect any better from such people. They're only living according to their traditions. Tradition seems to mean everything on this planet.
Barris sampled another of the numerous drinks that had been set before her. Like everything else she had tried, it was delicious. Movement off to her right made her turn. Her diminutive friend was ambling toward the doorway.
Tuki, where are you going?
Too much, much light for Tuki. Too much talk, talk. Go for a walk. Back later.
Fine, she told him, adding after a moment's thought.
Don't steal anything.
He responded with a gesture whose meaning she would have demanded to know had he not already disappeared. One of the guards stationed outside made a move to intercept him, but the Gwurin was too quick, vanishing into the night and the camp. Now that was a bit odd, Barris thought. Why would they try to keep Tuki from leaving? She relaxed and leaned back against the cushions, probably worried about him running loose and getting into trouble. Knowing Tuki, she could sympathize with their hosts. A stylishly clad and elaborately coiffured female brought forth an elegant rectangular case filled with delicate, tightly stoppered bottles. Each was unique, having been fashioned from a different natural gemstone. The server's attire left her back completely uncovered in a sweeping open V, the better to show off her golden black-striped mane all the way to her short stub of a tail. Glistening bows and light-emitting sparklies had been artfully woven into the exposed fur. At the chief's direction, she bent to proffer the assortment to Luminara and Obi-Wan.
"These are essences from the Zavak Lakes district, far to the west of here,"
Bayuntu spoke pridefully.
"You will not find the like anywhere in Kupernam. I would champion them in a contest of fine perfumes against any scents acquired anywhere in the Republic."
He waved a thick-fingered hand encouragingly.
"Go on, go on, try them."
"The Paluruvu, that's the violet-hued liquid in the bottle at the end of the display, is particularly flamboyant. A couple of drops of the pure essence blended with clear water will make a large flagon of expensive perfume."
He smiled broadly.
"The Alwari may be prairie-dwelling nomads, but they are not uncivilized. Like the Kulun, they too enjoy the finer things. These essences are among our best sellers. After days spent traveling the open plains in the company of a great many reeking herd and draft animals, a well-off Alwari couple is grateful for the opportunity to moderate the natural bouquet within their home."
Tentatively, Luminara tried a whiff of several of the different extracts. All were outstanding, but true to Bayuntu's word, the Paluruvu was exceptional.
"Wonderful," she declared, as she passed the tray to Obi-Wan.
His sampling was more perfunctory than hers, but he too had to admit that the assortment was the equal of anything he had encountered on Coruscant or any other equally sophisticated world of the Republic. By the time Barris and Anakin took their turn, the room was awash in a spectacular swirl of scents. These cloaked the atmosphere entirely, drowning out any hint of corralled animals or bustling clan folk. As Luminara looked on, Bayuntu yawned hugely. Come to think of it, she was feeling quite weary herself. It had been a long day. Straightening, she prepared to excuse herself and her companions. That was the first inkling she had that something was wrong. She couldn't straighten. In fact, she could not even sit up. Her taut, lean muscles seemed to have turned to mush, to have buckled into the cushions and pillows that supported them. Her head swam, and she felt like she was melting into the floor. Out of rapidly blurring eyes, she saw Obi-Wan rise and attempt to draw his lightsaber. His fingers clutched futilely in its vicinity. Even if he had succeeded in drawing and activating the weapon, there was no one to fight. Their host was already wheezing away sonorously, his hands clasped across his most un-Ancionian belly. The eye-catching essence presenter was lying nearby, her lithe form sound asleep at his feet.
"Something's... Barris..."
Attempting to shout, Luminara produced only a loud whisper. Her Padawan did not hear her. Barris lay sprawled on her own cushioning divan,
head back, mouth open, and limbs akimbo. Not far away, Anakin Skywalker lay face down a body length or two from the entrance to the visitor's house. A house Luminara saw through a thickening haze, whose doors had been firmly and surreptitiously shut tight. To keep them in, she wondered, or to seal in the striking, swirling mélange of fragrances. It amounted, she realized, to the same thing. Palaruvu not only excited the sense of smell, she thought woozily, it also must contain the powerful sedative that was rendering her and her companions senseless. But if the result was intentional, why would Bayuntu subject himself and the female who had offered it up to the same sleep-inducing effects? Struggling to crawl toward the door, she tried to draw her own weapon. The effort was to no avail. Her brain no longer seemed capable of establishing contact with her fingers. Nearby, Obi-Wan dropped to his knees and looked over at her. His expression was blank, drugged. As she stared, his eyes closed and he fell over onto his side. On the far side of the room, Kyakta and Bulgan snorted loudly in the familiar wheezing, hissing Ancyonian manner. Exerting a tremendous effort, Anakin Skywalker rose to his feet and rushed at the shuttered entrance. Through the increasingly dense haze that was clogging her thoughts, she marveled at the attempt. The youth must have an enormous reservoir of willpower, she decided. Unfortunately, all of it was expended in reaching the door. By the time he struck it, Anakin's legs were barely able to hold him erect. The doors shuddered, but held firm. Retreating, he reached for his lightsaber, turned a slow, confused circle, and sat down. His eyes closed, and he fell over onto his side. She was now the only one in the room who was still conscious. Of course Bayuntu would subject himself and the serving female to the effects of the immobilizing perfume, she found herself thinking. How better to put someone you wanted to poison at ease than by partaking of that same poison yourself? If nothing else, it suggested that the narcotizing procedure was not fatal. Bayuntu might be the type to join his intended victims in sleep, but not in death. She saw it all clearly now. They had been lured in and rendered helpless. But for what purpose? To what end? A part of her brain screamed at her to keep awake, to stay alert. Fighting the perfume's effects, she managed to lift her head off the cushions. It was a last defiant gesture. Even Jedi training could be overcome, perhaps not by force of arms. But a lightsaber was useless against the delectable, all-pervasive, irresistible fragrance of essence of Palaruvu.
There's the grotty little Dizat! Get him!
Tuki didn't know why the two Kaloon were chasing him, but he didn't hang around to find out. Both clan members were brandishing strange foreign weapons, and even though he didn't know what they were or what they could do, he decided right away that it would be better not to wait around to see. Something bad must have happened. If Master Barriss was all right, she wouldn't stand for him being chased like this by screaming, wild-eyed, angry Kaloon. Something bright and hot singed the hair on the crest of his mane. He accelerated, running as hard and fast as he could. Though the Kaloon people had longer legs, they were accustomed to riding and selling. If there was one thing the Gwurran knew how to do and did well, it was running.
This way!
A Kaloon shouted.
I saw the Dizat over this way! I am not a Dizat!
He wanted to turn and yell. However, he was also smart enough to know that the moment of foolish defiance might very well cost him his life. Frantically, he hunted for some place to go to ground. But there were no familiar hills here, no friendly clefts or crevices down which to duck. He wondered if he would live long enough to set eyes on one of those people-filled, magical, mysterious places only a very few Gwurran had ever visited. That was when he saw the Kolok burrow. The entrance was just big enough for him to squeeze into. Panting hard, he wriggled himself through the opening and started down the incline on his belly. Would the Kaloon think to look for him under the ground or just on top of it? The burrow widened slightly, allowing him to crawl faster. When it opened into an oval chamber three times his size, he knew he had reached the end. Muted by the intervening earth, the shouts and cries of the patrolling Kulun sounded more distant than they were. It would have been a perfect hiding place, except for one complication. It was already occupied by a family of Kolot. He froze. The Kolot ate grasses and grains and leaves, not Gwuren. At least he hoped so. Flat of face and covered in prickly olive-green fur, the two adults regarded him warily. Thankfully, there were no cubs in the burrow. If there had been, he probably wouldn't have made it this far. Each adult was almost as big as he was. Their teeth, unfortunately, were much bigger. Wide, heavy-duty incisors designed for slicing through large clumps of grass. If their blunt-snouted owners were so inclined, they could also slice right through his face. He held his breath as they approached, snuffling and grunting, and tried not to tremble too much as they sniffed him over and up and all around. Eyes shut tight, he tried to imagine himself a piece of dorgum dung that had accidentally rolled down into their burrow. The sounds of tromping Sadanes and their Kulun riders still reached him from above. He did not know how much longer he could remain motionless. With a last disdainful sniff that at another time the terrified Tuki might have taken as an insult, the pair of Kolot pushed past him and headed up the tunnel. Their reaction was more than passing strange. Surely he couldn't smell bad enough to force them to vacate their burrow. Then he remembered the time spent in the Kulun visitor's house, swathed in foreign smells and peculiar aromas. Evidently, enough of that had adhered to his fur not only to drive the Kolot out, but to keep them from biting him. Smell bad, taste bad, the two burrowing grazers had apparently decided. There was an excited yell from above, followed by a sharp crackling sound and a pained yowl from one of the Kolot. Emerging from the burrow, it had been mistaken for his quarry by one of the patrolling Kulun. As soon as the unfortunate grazer had been identified, the other Kulun had a good laugh at their trigger-happy comrade's expense. Turning himself around in the cramped chamber, Tuki put his head partway up the tunnel and listened intently.
Enough of this! It's late and I'm tired. I don't care what Bayuntu says.
Same here, declared another Kulun firmly, reining in his Sadane.
Let's tell him we caught and killed the runaway and be done with it.
It's alone out here without food or water or supplies. The prairie will finish it off. This confident exchange was followed by the sound of many Sadane feet moving swiftly away. Even so, Tuki remained hidden in the burrow until he was certain it was safe to emerge. When he finally did so, tired and dirty but alive, there was no sign of his pursuers. Finding a rock, he climbed just high enough to see over the tops of the windswept grass. The Kulun were breaking camp, and in the middle of the night at that. They must be very anxious about something to do that, he knew. As far as Tuki knew, no nomads had ever been observed breaking camp in the middle of the night. Were Master Barris and her friends still alive? If they were still alive, he suspected that his life was going to get even more complicated than it already was.